Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
All right, today we're going to finish up section. Or I know my words are sometimes confusing. I realize we're going to finish up the second part of the story. Our story that we're studying is three parts. We started again with the expulsion of Hagar, really, from the house of Avram, where Avram was kicked out of, where Hagar was kicked out of the house. We moved into the second story, which is in the middle of here, which is the expulsion of Yishmael, where Hagar returns, she has this child, and then Hagar, Yishmael himself is then kicked out, and this is going to lead into the third story, which will start in Ritz Hashem, which is going to be the actual binding of Isaac at the Akedah. We're going to take a look back at all of them and put them all together. I think you'll find it very fascinating, I hope. But we're finishing up now chapter 21, which is the middle part of the story. I had broken this chapter up into three different parts, and we are now doing the last of those sections in which Yitzchak has been born. Sarah has requested, really demanded, that the child of Yishmael now be kicked out of the house. He was a negative influence on Yitzchak. He's a mitzachek. He was making a mockery. I'm going to foreshadow some of the things that we'll talk about in a few moments. If you recall, when we learned this the first time, a couple weeks ago already, what it was exactly that Yishmael was doing is very vague in the Torah. The language is used as he was mitzachek, he was making a mockery of sorts. That's all that's discussed. And there are two basic approaches that we find in the commentaries that we have studied as to exactly what it was that he was doing. Rashi quotes them both. The first thing that Rashi quoted was that it was his behavior which was negative, or a possible negative influence on Yitzchak. He was involved in three cardinal sins of idolatry or adultery or murder. And as such, Sarah sees the negative influence on Yitzchak and says that the child must be out. Avraham either thought he could outweigh that or something or another. He wasn't clearly as aware of it, but somehow it was his behavior. The second approach that Rashi said, which some of the other commentators take as well, is that it was an inheritance issue. That Yishmael was claiming rights to the inheritance of Avraham, that he was going to be the person in charge. Rashi quoted it as he was making a mockery of the weaning process. That he was saying, I don't know, making such a big deal about this. Anyway, he wasn't really born from Avraham, he was born from Avimelech, the king that was the previous story right before that, because remember, Sarah and Avraham had been married for decades and decades and no children. Sarah is taken captive by a foreign king, and all of a sudden she gets pregnant, and Yishmael was poking fun, saying, I'm really the only legitimate child, I'm the one who's going to have the inheritance, I'm the eldest, I get the double portion. And it was really not an issue necessarily about negative behavior, but about the future of the Abrahamic household as to who was going to be in control. And that was also a potential issue that was on the table here. But in either case, Sarah has her sent out. Avram doesn't want to. Hashem comes to Avram and says, listen to the voice of your wife. She knows what it is that she's speaking about. This is something that needs to be done. And that's what we got up to. We are doing verses 14 through 21. We did the first three last week. First three, which we'll just quickly review the actual text, in which Avram arises early in the morning. If you remember, the exercise that we were engaging in last week was finding the phrases which will appear in the story of the binding of Yitzchak as well. Finding the parallel type text and phrases. So Avram arises early in the morning, and that was the obvious first start. What happened the beginning of the binding of Isaac as well? Avraham wakes up early morning. For those, I just want to borrow a phrase. Those of you who had the privilege of hearing Rabbi David Foreman when he was here a few weeks ago, so he very informally refers to this, which is there's a more formal literary style for it. He just informally refers to it as, where have we heard this before? And he just likes to refer to that a lot during his lectures as, well, where have we heard this before? So where have we heard the phrase, and Avram awoke early in the morning? Well, from the Akedah. Why does the Torah do that? The Torah is trying to point out and say, you need to understand this story to understand this story. The two of them go together when you find lots of phrases like that that connect certain stories. So then you have to pay attention to that. And certainly the overarching theme of the story is very similar. Avram is being asked to take a child of his and to remove that child. In the case of Yishmael, to permanently send him away from the home. In the case of Yitzchak, to offer him as a sacrifice, also to forever say goodbye to him. In both of those scenarios, Avram is being asked a very similar task, And both stories start, Avram arose early in the morning, pointing out there are certain parallels here in the story. So he takes the bread and he takes the leather pouch of water and he gives them to Hagar. He does not give them to Yishmael. He gives them to his mother, Hagar, placing them on her shoulder and the child, and he sends her away, and she goes and she wanders in the desert of Beersheba. We saw last week the two approaches, whether or not he placed the actual child himself as well on her shoulder, or whether or not she just took him along with her. Either way, they are both sent away from the home. Vayichlu hamayim in hachemes, in 15, the water was depleted. Vatashleches hayelet, and she sends forth the child. So we're going to note that language, which we'll come back to both in this story as well as in the Binding of Isaac. Here we have a parent sending forth the child, as opposed to taking a child in. Here is a sending of the child out, tachas achat hasichim, under one of the bushes, as we saw in the poetic language of Rav Hirsch, just cast aside wherever he may land, be it. But she just sort of drops him, disposes of him by one of the bushes. And where does she go? Vatelech vateshiv la mineget, she goes a distance of a bow shots away from him. Rav Hirsch's language, as we saw yesterday, was not, he doesn't agree with this translation of two bow shots, but that she went like an archer away, one who backs away from a target, facing the target as they move back, finding the place that's far away enough that I can still hit my target, but not too close that I can actually see it. In the same way as an archer wants to be at the maximum distance away and still be able to strike their target, that's the perfect placement for an archer, strategically speaking. So she, like an archer, went as far away as she could be from him, and yet still somehow see what's going on. And this was the approach that she had to dealing with the death of her child. I don't want to be near, and I want to be as far away as I possibly could. Let me not see the child's death, she says, and she raises up her voice and she cries. Okay, 17 is where we started. Just, we read the text. Let's now take a look at Tulsi Rashi and the Ramban. So let's just read the text again. And God heard the lad's voice. Vayishma Elokim es kol hanar. So we noted, let's just go again, we'll pick up with this. What's significant about God hearing his voice? What's the child's name?
Yishmael.
Yishma, God, he will hear, God will hear. His name was rooted in God hearing the affliction of Hagar when she herself was kicked out of the house of Avram and Sarah. In the first story that we read, God has heard your affliction. And the child's name carries God's name in it, Yishmael. God's name is a part of the child's name that God will hear. He's a nation that's going to develop into one who prays and has that relationship with God. As we saw in her first, she spoke about in his beautiful language, the father Avraham has his influence. There might be a mother of Hagar, but in the same way as Avraham is our spiritual father, Avraham is his spirit, so God hears. What does the Torah call Yishmael here?
The lad.
The lad. So you know, it's just interesting points. How many different ways has he been referred to in our story here? Just in chapter 1, chapter 21 alone, what we've read. Starting with, you know, verse 9. Right, in verse 10, verse 9, we see him already as the son of Hagar the Egyptian. So the Torah describes him as, in verse 9, the son of Hagar. How does Sarah herself describe the child in verse 10?
Son of a handmaid.
Son of a handmaid. How does Avram describe the child in verse 11?
His son.
And in verse 12, how does God refer to the child?
The lad.
The lad. It's very interesting that this child is not identified by name by the Torah original, not by name ever. Right, in all of these stories, no matter who's referring to the child, he is not called Yishmael in this entire chapter. Since his birth in the previous chapter, now we don't see him by name. He's referred to as the son of the handmaid. He's the son of Hagar. He is Avraham's son, or he's just the lad, as God refers to him as, but never as Yishmael. And here, now later in the story, in verse 17, where the child is ill, dying of thirst, literally cast aside by one of the bushes, and the angel calls out to Hagar, and again, How does he refer, or even before the angel calls out, when God himself in the beginning of the verse hears the child's voice, it again just refers to him as the lad. Not as Hagar's son, not the son of the handmaid, not Abraham's son, just as the lad. So God hears the voice of the lad, which again fits with the child's name. Now, we noted last week, and we'll note again now, the Torah had not told us that the lad himself was crying. The Torah told us who was crying.
Hagar.
So it would have made more sense to tell us that God heard her voice, because if you made the point of saying that she's the one crying, so we should be hearing her voice. But we don't hear her voice. God only hears Yishmael's voice, and we can infer from here that he had clearly been crying as well, which makes it even more painful to understand Hagar's response. If it was that he was unconscious and he was dying and she said, I can't bear it, but he's not suffering, it's one thing. But the child's crying. Child's crying and she's leaving him here by the side of the bushes, and God hears the voice of the lad. Vayikra malach Elokim el Hagar min ha-shamayim. And an angel of God calls out to Hagar from heaven. Where have we heard this phrase before?
When she ran away the first time.
Okay, we have God calling out. And where in our Binding of Isaac story?
We haven't
gotten to that, but if you remember the story, and we're just going to foreshadow that, when Avram has literally at the point of death, same point of death that we have here of Ishmael dying of thirst, she's away at a distance, life is about to ebb away from the child, and an angel of God calls out from heaven, so too by Avram with his knife drawn in his hand, about to put it on the throat of his son, at the point of death, the same phrase we're going to see, an angel of God is going to call out from heaven. Same phraseology we're going to have, so we're going to have that tell, and we're literally at the same point in the story where the child's just about to die. Parent is involved. In the case of Avram, of course, it's the father. Here it's the mother. And obviously the difference is if Avram is the one doing it, here Hagar is off to a distance, but the angel is calling out at this point. And the angel says, Ma vayomer lo, Maloch Hagar, what is troubling you, Hagar? Al tir'i ki shema lukim et kol anar, fear not, because God has heard the lad's voice, ba'asher husham, in the place where he is.
How
okay.
Old is he now?
He's about 17.
17?
About 17 years old. Now, al tir'i, do not be afraid. So, you'd have to have a very good memory of the story of the binding of Isaac to remember this particular reference, but we'll get to it, but we'll just again foreshadow the phrase. The angel is going to call out to Avram and say, you have proven yourself, ki yorei Elokim ata, you are one who fears God. Because you have done this and not withheld your son from me, I see that you fear God. Now we're going to have to talk when we get to the binding, that whole story, in terms of what is the test about and what does Avram prove. But again, in just finding the parallels of where have we seen these words before, in the same way that the angel here, and again, this is we haven't seen the binding of Isaac, so I'm just foreshadowing as we see that, interesting parallels that we have here. The angel calls out, the Torah describes it in the same way as it does by the binding. There where it says to Avram, I see that you are one who fears God. Here he says to Hagar, do not fear. What's troubling you? What's troubling me? My son's about to die. He's over there. He's dying of thirst. And the angel calls out and says, do not fear, because God has heard the voice of the lad. You might not have heard the voice of the lad. You're all the way over there. But God has heard the voice of the lad, ba'asher hu sham, in the place where he is. Now, this is where we left off. What is that phrase? In the place, it's an extraneous phrase. It doesn't seem to tell us anything about the story here. What do you mean that God has heard the voice of the lad in the place that he is? What does the phrase even mean, in the place? Is it a physical place? God has heard the lad where he is, under that bush? Or is it in a spiritual sense? What does this phrase mean? So we're going to see both interpretations. The simple interpretation we'll see in the Ramban, meaning in the physical place that he is, and the sages are going to see that on another level, meaning in the spiritual place that he is. Let's take a look right now. So in your sheet, your Rashi sheet, let's take a look at this sheet, the double-sided sheet with the Rashi and the Ramban. On the Rashi side, labeled number 1, right in the middle of the page, starting with verse 17, es kol hana'ar, God has heard the voice of the lad. Everybody see where I am?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mikan, Rashi says, from here we see a very interesting principle. If I'll ask it as a question first. If two people are praying on behalf of a person who is deathly ill, the person himself who is ill, or others on behalf of the person who is ill, whose prayer does God hear more?
The
So I would have made an argument. You read ahead. I saw you.
No.
Yeah, I saw you. I saw you reading ahead. So so I would have argued, and that might, you can give me an argument if you'd like. I would have made an argument for someone else, because the person himself would say, of course he's praying for himself. Like, that, you know, that I would expect that that's more just out of a selfish, you know, self-preservation desire. But if I can muster up, now this, again, I'm assuming all things being equal, it's with the same fervor, the two prayers. If I can muster up on behalf of someone else the same fervor that that person has for himself, I could have made an argument that that's quite a prayer. That would be, I would be able to do that. But Rashi is going to say from here, not like what I would have said. He's going to prove from here that it's exactly the opposite, the arguments that you would have made, whether you did or did not look ahead. Rashi says, from here we learn that God hears the voice of the lad, that the prayer of the sick person is more effective than the prayers of others on his behalf. And that it is answered first, because the Torah tells us God heard the voice of the lad, not the voice of his mother, who was crying on behalf of the lad. Now, you remember that Refersh commented that the child, the mother's voice, has something negative affiliated with it. That the fact that she had distanced herself from the child actually made her cry a selfish cry, that she was only concerned with herself and not seeing the plight of this child. But that being notwithstanding, Rashi points out that we see from here that when a person is ill and they themselves beseech God, they themselves are answered first, because after all, that really is the purpose of the illness, is ourselves coming and reaching out to God and seeing our dependency upon. That's the fulfillment of the reason why we got sick in the first place. So from here Rashi derives, and this is, you'll see that a person is answered themselves when they have called out to God in prayer in our own moments of suffering. Okay, Basher Husham, in the place where he is. So he mentioned this is a funny phrase. What do you mean that God heard the child in the place where he is? So Rashi here is going to quote a long statement from the sages, and it is dealing with it, meaning in the spiritual sense of the place where he is, God has heard his prayer. Says Rashi as follows, meaning, Lefi ma'asim, in accordance with the deeds that he does at present, he is judged. Meaning God has heard his prayers in the place where he is, based on who he is right now, he will be judged. And not in accordance with what he is destined to do. Meaning God judges where you are now, Ba'asher Husham, where you stand, not where you, what you're going to do in the future. Meaning to say as follows, say the sages. For the ministering angels were mekatreg, they were claiming against Yishmael, saying, Master of the world, Ribono Shalom, he whose descendants are destined to put your children to death by thirst, you're going to cause a miracle and a well to rise up to save him? How can you save this child? Do you know what this child is going to do? This child is going to have descendants who are going to be killing your children. And for him, you're going to perform a miracle? You're going to change the nature of the world in order to be able to save him? And God answers them, but what is he now? I judge Ba'asher Husham, where a person is now when I'm judging him, not based on what's going to happen about his future descendants. Achshav Mahu, but what is he now? Tzadik or Rosho? Is he righteous or wicked? And they said to him, Tzadik, he's righteous. He said to them, in accordance with his deeds at present, I will judge. And that is the meaning, say the sages, of Ba'asher Husham, as he is there. God heard the plea, the cries of the lad as he was there in his place, meaning the ministering angel said, how could you save this child? His descendants are going to be slaughtering your children. And God says, but I don't look at the future generations. I look at the child where he is. What is he now, righteous or wicked? That's interesting. We know that, why was he kicked out of the house of Abraham?
I was going to ask you that question.
Right? He was kicked out of the house of Abraham because Sarah sees him mitzachek, as Rashi himself quoted, idolatry, adultery, murder. He was playing around in ways that were not safe to Yitzchak and his own personal spiritual development, and now the ministering angels claim that he's righteous. So it seems it has to do with the fact that he's crying out. In other words, here he is, the child is clearly crying, and on some level, so where is he now? In the same way as we say on Yom Kippur, a person who cries out to God with true repentance in that moment, that's who he is right now. That's what establishes a person as a mission perkeva. Shuv yomechel, right? Repent the moments, even the final moments before a person dies. God's always waiting with open arms to bring you in. And here is Yishmael crying on his deathbed, about to die as a child of 17. To which the sages say, the ministering angels acknowledge, right now at this moment he's a tzaddik. At this moment he doesn't deserve to die. And God says, that's what I'll judge. Now there's a lot of talk, which I want to just briefly mention. There's a lot of talk. There's an oft-quoted mitzvah in the Torah, which is one of the more fascinating mitzvahs in the Torah, which seems to have the exact opposite approach of this particular Rashi. There's a young child who's known as a ben sorer umora, a wayward son, who at the age of 13 steals money from his parents, and he goes and he buys meat and wine, and he gets himself drunk, and he's sentenced to death by the Torah, this little boy. And the Gemara asks, like, what did he do? He stole a bit of money. He stole some bought some meat and some wine. Like, why would we put this child to death? And the Gemara says, well, if a child who's 13 does this, we know his end is going to be a murderer. So it's better to kill him now while he's still considered innocent, and he'll merit the world to come, than to put him to death as a murderer. At which point, he will have forfeited his rights to come, his rights in the world to come. And everybody asks, wait a minute. That's not what happens over here. In our story, God says, I deal with him right here. What is he now? Is he righteous or is he wicked? There's a lot of talk about this. I don't want to get into the whole thing. The simplest answer is there's a fundamental difference between judging the person himself and his descendants. The angels claim against Yishmael, not that Yishmael himself is going to be a thorn in the side of the Jewish people, but that his descendants are going to be a thorn in the side of the Jewish people. And as far as that goes, so God says, I'm not going to necessarily look I'm not going to judge him based on his future descendants. Whereas the person himself, it might be to his own benefit to be judged now than it would be to be judged later. There's a lot of talk about that. Too far off of what we're doing, but just to note that this idea that we have here in this Rashi is part of a very famous discussion. The next time you hear that at someone's table, you'll say, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the contradiction between how God treated Yishmael versus this ben sorer umora, this wayward son. He's judged what's referred to as al shem sofo, based on what he's destined to do. Whereas here in Yishmael, we do not do that. This is part of those great discussions which I'm sure you've have been involved in. If someone would say, if in 1933 you had a chance to kill Hitler, would you have done it or would you not have done it? Would it be the right thing to do or not the right thing to do? And it's one of the great philosophical debates. I mean, at that point the man was innocent. He hadn't done anything. But if you have the hindsight to know, or at that point to be considered the foresight, to know what it was that he was going to do, is that correct or is that not correct? So it's a very interesting discussion, and that often gets brought into this kind of discussion where you have here Yishmael, and God says, I judge Ba'asher Husham in the place that he is now. And right now, if he's deserving to be saved, I'm going to save him, and I'm not interested in what his descendants will do. What about the person himself? That's the discussion of Ben Sorer Mor, a very interesting discussion. But you would need something like the Torah to tell you what we know he's going to end up doing. It's hard for human beings ever to say. And that's why it's a philosophical discussion, because in practice, we can never deal with anything other than what's in front of us. We never have the rights to say, oh, we know what it's going to be. That's why it's philosophical. That's why it's a great debate where there's no real end. Like, what's the answer to the question? Like, if you knew at the time what Hitler was going to do, yeah, but we don't. We never do. We never can. So it's just a philosophical debate.
He was judged that way when they told Helga to leave. He was judged by his present actions.
Right, that he couldn't be involved in the household because he was going to lead Yitzhak astray.
Okay, and right. It's like a change of heart, you know. When
well, he didn't necessarily deserve to die. In other words, that gets back to the story in terms of they started wandering in the desert and he got sick and he drank more than they had expected. But his sentence wasn't to die because his promise, Abram had been promised that this child will become a great nation. He was promised that, and he was promised that again when he sends him out. It's repeated, he will be a nation, not to worry.
Mm-hmm.
So he was sentenced that he was, while not permitted to stay with the house of Abraham, he was not sentenced that he needed to be killed. And so here, where he's about to die, God says, I'll judge him where he is now, and we will keep him alive.
Did they have something about the fact that crying out was considered to shuva for him?
It seems.
I'm coming closer to Hashem. Did he stay clean of. In the end, he did tshuva.
In the end, the sages say he does do tshuva because the sages derived it from the fact that when Avraham dies, the Torah describes both Yishmael and Yitzchak coming to bury him together.
Mm-hmm. And is that where it mentions Yitzchak's names first?
I don't remember that.
Doesn't it make a difference the intention that the individual has? For instance, Shmuel didn't have any intentions, but Hitler did.
At which point?
At the point that you put him judging Hitler.
Yeah.
He knew what he was going to do.
Okay, but he still hadn't done it. We as human beings can never judge that, right? Yeah, but we can't deal with that. In other words, the Torah might deal with it. We can't deal with that. I found that you are correct. In other words, the pasuk says that Avram died. This is at the end of Parshas Chayesara. Vayikbru also Yitzchak v'Yishmael banav amarat haMachpelah, and his sons Yitzchak and Yishmael came to bury him in the cave of Machpelah, which he had purchased. It lists Yitzchak before Yishmael, even though Yishmael was clearly older. But from the fact that they both came, the sages do derive that Yitzchak Yishmael had either done true at this point in his life, was certainly on the in the correct place. And I believe there's a statement from the sages I don't have in front of me, if I remember correctly, that the Torah says Avram even died 5 years early in order that he shouldn't see his son Yishmael begin his path of wickedness. I don't have the chumash on that. I believe they're both stated. Okay, moving on. So the end of the Rashi just quotes, where do we see the children of Yishmael causing death to the children of Israel? So the Rashi just quotes it that when Nebuchadnezzar exiled the Jewish people after the destruction of the first temple, says the verse describes a prophecy concerning Arabia, that towards the thirsty they bring water, that it alludes to the Babylonians were leading the Jews near the Arabs who were descendants of Yishmael following the destructions, and the Bnei Yisrael, the Jews would say to their captors, we beseech you, take us to the children of our uncle Yishmael and they will have mercy on us. So the Yishmaelites then went out to greet the Jews who were now captives after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and they brought them meat and salted fish and inflated skin flasks. So the Jews thought they were under the impression that they were filled with water. So after they would eat the salty fish and they would need to take a drink, they would put the flask into his mouth and open it, and the air which was in the flask would enter his body and kill him. So that they, instead of being filled with water, they filled with a vacuum of air, and they would basically die. So the sages have a tradition as to what took place from the Bnei Yishmael when we were leaving the land of Israel as captives. And this is a reference that the angels, the ministering angel, says to God, how can you possibly render a miracle for this child? Look at what his children are going to do to your children, specifically with thirst. And you're going to create a well for him? And God says, I judge based on where he is right now. And right now he is deserving of being saved. Flip the page over, if you will, to the Ramban. So the Ramban on the bottom of the page, starting with verse 17, so the first half of that piece quotes Rashi. And then on the bottom he says what he thinks is starting the brackets there. Having cited Rashi's Midrashic interpretation, which we just read, the Ramban presents his opinion about the simple explanation of the verses. Says the Ramban, what does it mean in the place that he is? The soundest interpretation, in my view, is following the simple explanation, is that the Torah is saying that God heard the voice of the youth in the place where he was, in the following sense, that God informed her that Yishmael would not have to walk from there to a spring or cistern, for in that very place he would quench his thirst immediately. Meaning to say, this is part of the prophecy. The angel calls out to Hagar and says, God has heard the voice of the lad in the place that he is. When God renders miracles and salvation, it's not even like, guess what? In another half mile, you'll find an oasis. You just have to... No. When God says, I heard the voice of the child and he will be saved, it's done. In the place where he is, there's like nothing here. You're in the middle of a desert. He's dying of thirst. When I get involved and I hear the cry of the lad, Ba'asher hu shav, in the place where you are, where you think there's no hope, it's impossible, my salvation doesn't come by saying, oh, I can take you somewhere else, I'll move you to a place where it's good. In the place where you are, where you think it's impossible and there's nothing that can be done, no. Right there, you don't have to move an inch. I'm going to provide the salvation. It's a beautiful explanation from the Rabban and the simple meaning of the text, what that extra phrase is of saying in the place that he is in terms of the way that God saves and provides his miraculous wonders. And then the sages see in there that it's in the spiritual sense that God is saying, I will save him in the place that he's at now, meaning in his spiritual sense that he's worthy of being saved and I will do so. Both of them are very beautiful explanations of this particular phrase. Flip to the next page, rehearse. Let's do verse by verse while we're going along here. On the bottom of page 357. Everybody, Gabby?
Mm-hmm.
From the bottom of page 357 on our verse, God has already heard your child, right? The angel calls out to Hagar and says, God has heard the voice, not your voice, because the first, if you remember, said, your voice is a selfish voice. Your voice is a cry of tears. I can't stand the pain of seeing my child. That's not the voice that God hears, but God heard the voice of the child that where he lies struggling, meaning in the place where he is, where he's struggling, God has heard his voice. Had you, Hagar, put your trust in God, had you not thrown your child there, but laid him gently down, had you not left him, but had you remained by him as becomes a mother, then you would have already seen as well that just where he is. There, just where he is.
The well.
Right, excuse me, I'm sorry. Then you would have already seen the well, which is about to appear, just where he is. Meaning, refers to saying another beautiful explanation, that Ba'asher Husham, he's there. Meaning, you're not. You cast him aside and went somewhere else. You don't hear his cries because you're busy with your own. And therefore the angel has to call out there and say, Hagar, where you, which, what troubles you? Why are you worried? Meaning, you're not where you need to be. Had you been where you needed to be, had you been as a mother should with your child in his despair, had you had faith and trust in God for taking care of the child that he promised you as well will be a great nation, you would be there, and then you would have seen the salvation. Your problem is because you're in the wrong place. You abandoned the situation that was called of you, both from a perspective of faith and from a perspective of your parental responsibilities. And because you've abandoned your space, you're troubled. And the angel's cry, which we ask, like, what a funny question the angel has, like, what troubles you? He's saying, what troubles you? Meaning, you're only being troubled because you're over here. If you would be over there, you would already see the salvation. You would already see that God has heard his cry and brought the answer. But because you've abandoned that which is motherly, you've abandoned that which is required in terms of faith and in trust in God, therefore you're not in the right place and you're missing that which is going on. Like, where is God for me now? Well, he's right where he's supposed to be. You're not in the right place. Very, very beautiful explanation as well. Okay, let's take a look back at our verse. Verse 18. What does the angel then continue to say? Kumi! Rise up, si'es hana'ar. Pick up the lad. Now we're going to foreshadow, we're going to see this type of phraseology as well in the Akedah story, the binding of Isaac of Si'i. Lift up the lad. Now, even in our story, what have we seen so far been done to this child? First he was cast aside, and now he's being lifted up. We have the shoulders, right? Who's carrying? Hagar's carrying stuff on her shoulders. We're going to see other people carrying stuff on shoulders as well. There are lots of parallels. So here we have the phrase, the angel calls out. Now again, the angel calls out two things to Avram as well. Here we're going to have, this is the second statement now of the angel calling out to Hagar. Rise up is being said to Hagar. Si'i es hana'ar, lift up the child, v'achziki es yodech bo, and grasp your hand upon him. Ki l'goy gadol asimenu, for I shall make him into a great nation. So here we have a promise at the end of the story of the child becoming a great nation. We'll see if we find anything like that in the story of the binding of Isaac. At the end of the story, a promise of becoming a great nation. And we have this extra phrase. This whole phrase seems a little bit interesting. Rise up, lift up the child and grasp hold of him with your hand. This is just like interesting what it is that he wants. He wants her physically, it sounds like, to pick up the child and then hold him with her hand. I believe both Rashi and Rabban have nothing to say on that. Rav Hirsch has comments. If you take a look at your sheets from Rav Hirsch, in verse 18. First, get up and take the lad again as a strong, never despairing mother. First thing you need to do is you need to change your perspective or approach to it. Right now you're a despairing mother that cast the child aside. Page 358.
Okay, that's where I am. Okay, I thought you moved to
it. Yeah, no, verse 18, page 358. Sorry, I'm moving quickly. Got me?
No, I got
you. So first the angel says, Kumi and Si'iya, so you have to pick up and take, you rise up and pick up the child, says a verse, as a strong, never despairing mother. You need to change your attitude. Right now you're a despairing, abandoning mother. You need to rise up and grab hold of him as a never despairing mother. For only as such are you worthy of God's help. Then give him to drink. So Hirsch is pointing out that the instructions of the angels first, when he hasn't mentioned anything about drinking yet. And all the angel has said is, don't worry, God has heard his cry, he's going to be a great nation. But before he says to where the salvation is going to come from, he says, rise up and pick up that child. You first, before the salvation can appear, before you actually find the well, you need to now reapproach your child as the loving mother that you need to be. So you need to go there and pick him up first. Then hold him by the hand. Let your hand keep a firm hold on him. Be a strong and firm support and guide to him, for I have destined him for a great future. So that Rav Hirsch sees it not as a physical hold him by the hand, but that be a support to him. Not this abandoning, casting aside, but you need to now be a support to him because this child is destined to become a great nation and he's going to need the support of you in order to become that. Verse 19, and God opened her eyes, Vayivkach Elokim Eseineha. What does this remind us of?
I don't have a verse 19.
Go back to your sheet. You do have it there?
Oh, but up on top.
On top, but if you look just at, you just look at the text.
I guess it's the finding of Isaac, Abraham. The,
right, all of a sudden, God, Avram looks up, and what's there? There's this ram. All of a sudden, there's this ram there, caught in the thicket, right, by its horns. And he looks up and he sees it. So here we have, at the end of the story, the angel calls out to her, and tells her what to do. Go there, grab hold of the child. And God opens up her eyes. And she sees a well of water. So the verse does not, describe it as if God created a well of water, but that he opened up her eyes and she suddenly saw it there. As if the imagery is one of the salvation is always there in front of us. That which we need, the solution to our problem, is always right there. We just can't see it. And the solution here comes not with the creation. It would have been a very different story, theologically speaking, had we had this child here dying of thirst, and God said, I hear the voice of the lad, he will be a great nation, I will save him, poof, and a well appears. Which would have been, none of us would have questioned that. That would have actually made a lot of sense, because obviously there was no well there, because they're dying of thirst in the desert. So that's what should have happened, right? He should have magically just created a well. And it's not how the Torah describes it. The Torah describes that suddenly her eyes were opened, and she saw the well. As if it had been there the whole time and she just couldn't see it, which is a very different image that the Torah is giving us as to the way that God provides the solutions to our problems. It's sometimes a matter of you can't see it, which is really the way we first understood the angel's message to Hagar. Go back, if you would be in the place where you need to be, you would already see it. What troubles you? You're only troubled because you're so far away. If you would be where you should be, you would already see the answer to your problems. That you've turned your back on the problem and abandoned it, you can't find the answer because it's over there. God opens up her eyes and she saw a well of water. She fills her pouch with water and gives to the lad to drink. Interesting here where she, again, the Torah refers to him as the lad. Out of all the different ways that we've seen him called, here I would have expected that she gives to
his son,
right? Either Yishmael or her son. Either one of those two would have made more sense, right? Calling him by name, or at least calling him, we've seen him referred to as the son of the handmaid, so that would have certainly been an appropriate place. And even here, it's just that distance, just she's given it to the lad. Verse 20, God was with the lad, and he grew, Vayeshev Bamidbar, and he dwelt in the desert. Vayehirove Koshos, and he becomes an archer. And as we've noted before, it's interesting at all why the Torah tells us what he becomes, but it's certainly interesting in the way that the Torah described how distant Hagar had gone from him when she drops him by the bushes. The Torah uses a phrase of a few bow's length away, a few bow shots away, which is a very strange way of describing distance. So strange that her first says, no, it didn't mean the distance, it means she backed away like an archer backs away. And that's all foreshadowing the fact that this child is going to become an archer. To the best of my knowledge, and this is verse 21, I don't think we've had anyone else described as an archer before until this point. I mean, first we've had people who work the fields, we've had shepherds. I don't know that we've had archers. We've heard described people who made musical instruments, made metal. I don't think we've had a description. Esav is an Ish HaSad, the man of the field, but Yishmael is specifically addressed here and described as an archer. Mm-hmm. It was a Rove Koshef. Let's take a look at Refersh, our final comment from Refersh on this. I'm sorry, two more. Says Refersh in verse 20, Rove Koshef. We've already explained on the word Peru Urvu. What is this word Rove? Rovu, where does that word come from? Says Refersh that Rove, Pru Urvu, lies the idea in Rove, lies the idea of spiritual education as parents can only reproduce themselves in their children if they make them spiritual replicas of themselves. The idea of being able to replicate one's own spiritual accomplishments in one's children is that if you can instill that same spiritual replica in the child, the child has that same spiritual level of the parent, then they've reproduced themselves in the children. Otherwise, they may have reproduced themselves physically. There is a child here, but this is not a child who's continuing in the path that the parents have set forth. That test is not in the physical creation of the child, but in the spiritual placement of the child. But in the exact opposite ways that we saw, as we first explained, when Sarah can't have a child and she gives Hagar to Abram for the first time, in the very beginning of the story, and she uses the words Ulai Bonemi Mena, maybe I will be built up through this child. And we asked all the commentators asked, what did she think was going to happen? I mean, this is going to be Hagar's child. And Refersh learned, if you remember, and said, no, there are two components to child raising. One is the physical creation of the child, and the other is the spiritual. Who is this child become? And Sarah said, I will be the mother of this child. I won't physically carry this child, but because it will be a result of my actions that the child is brought into the world, and it will be my spiritual contribution to the child that will raise the child, this will be my child. So here Refersh is pointing out, in the exact opposite sense, a person who gives birth to a child who's the physical reproduction of the parents, but has none of the spiritual elements, so then you've only replicated yourself in the physical sense. But we Jews view the world in a much deeper sense. So yes, there's a physical reproduction. There's a child in the world because of me. But then there's a spiritual component. And the concept of Peru Urvu, be multiply and be fruitful, however you want to literally translate the Refersh understands, I mean, multiply physically and imbue those children with the same spiritual quest and accomplishments as you have. That's the replication, the reproduction of the parents. So hence, Roveh, meaning an actual educating. Tarbus means discipline, education, and Rebbe, not master, but literally one who ranks above, but one who reproduces himself in his pupils. That's what a Rebbe is, from the same language of Peru Urvu, to multiply. What does it mean to multiply? To be a Rebbe, to be the spiritual teacher of others, so that I'm replicating myself in the students. And therefore, first says, what does it mean that Yishmael became a Rove Koshes? So he says that means a trainer of archers, and not Rove, a master of archers, who could have some other occupation also, whose principal occupation may have been something else. But he's not a master who might be doing other things, but he's a educator, he's a trainer of archers, one whose constant occupation was this. That's all that he did. He wasn't just a master archer. Refersh understands he was one who was constantly involved in the form of archery. Why is this so significant that we need to know about what Yishmael did? Don't have a great answer for you now. We'll see if we can come up with that a little bit longer later in our adventure in this story. But the Torah goes to great lengths to tell us exactly what Yishmael became. Last verse in 21. Vayeshev b'midbar Paran, he dwelt in the desert of Paran. Vatikachlo imo isha me eretz Mitzrayim, and his mother took for him a wife from the land of Egypt. Now, this has two elements to discuss. Number one, where have we seen this before? We're going to see this in the binding of Isaac again. The verses that you don't pay attention to because it's not the heart of the story, but at the end of the story, what happens immediately after they come back from the Akedah, the Torah tells us about the birth of Rivka, the woman who's eventually going to marry Yitzchak, and then the very next story begins with Avram sending off his slave Eliezer, servant, to go find the wife. So in the same way as the story of Yishmael ends with this element, the same type of ordeal of being sent away from Abraham, near death, angel of God calling out their salvation, and ends then with finding a wife. We're going to find that same pattern in the binding of Yitzchak as well. Abraham being told to send out the child, the near death, the angel of God calling out, those seeing the salvation in the form of the ram, the form of the well, and then moving right into the very next verses of the birth of his future wife, and then the procurement of that woman for him as a wife. We also see here, there was Abraham who's involved, and here of course it's Hagar who's involved. And he dwells in the desert, as we expected. The promise that he'd been given, the prophecy, was that he was going to be a wild man who's not going to be dwelling in the city. He's going to live out in the desert. And where does his wife find his mother find a wife for him from? From Egypt, which is where she was from. Where does Avram go to find a wife for his son Yitzchak? Back to from the place where he was from as well. And all those parallels sort of coming together. Take a look at one final comment from Rashi. If you look at your sheet, the Rashi Ramban sheet, at the very bottom of number one, Rashi points out something very interesting. The very bottom, verse 21 on the Rashi side, Rashi says, from the land of Egypt she took a wife, Mimakom Giduleha, from the place where she grew up, as it says, she had an Egyptian maidservant, so we know that Hagar was from Egypt. And this is what people say, says Rashi, the common saying, throw a stick into the air and it will land on its root. Right, Rashi likes to quote interesting phrases that people, like sayings that people had. If you throw something at it, on what side will it come down on? On its root. Why is that?
It's the heavier
side, right? But what's the meaning of that kind of phrase? That people always land, they always return
back to
their roots. Exactly. Return again, return again. Right, so we always go back to our roots. We go back to our roots as a Jewish people and in a macrocosm way. As a people, we return back to our roots, we return back to that which we are from, a desire to return to the land, to return to Torah, to return to God, to return to the roots of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And in a microcosm, in our personal lives, we always go back to that which we're comfortable. The roots that we lay are so critical because there's nothing like home. Whether or not it's the hometown, it's our physical home, it's the foods we ate when we were home, the way we celebrate Pesach, the roots that we lay in our personal lives, there's nothing like it. And we always go back to that as a security blanket, because that's how we function, that's the truth. We do that as a people, spiritually, we do it individually, spiritually, and we do it as people say, throw up a stick, it lands on its root. So where is Hagar? I need a wife for my son. Where is she going? Going back to Mitzrayim. Right, those, you know, you find that in people's lives, that which they grew up with, their roots are a very central part in their lives, and it's hard to move away from that because it's just, that's their roots. And therefore Rashi points this out here, the fact that Hagar goes back to Egypt to find a wife for her son, because that's where she came from, that's where she was comfortable, that's what she got. I get that, I understand it, I know it, and we return to our roots. As we mentioned before, that's the concept of teshuvah. Teshuvah means to, it doesn't mean repentance, it means to return. That's what the word means, vashuv, to return. That's why it's used to mean repentance, because that's what it means. It always means returning. And even to a Jew who never knew anything growing up, and he returns to Judaism, what do we call him? A Baal Teshuva. What's he returning to? He's new. It's not new. We're returning to our roots because we're spiritual people, and therefore what creates us is not just our physical existence. I never knew. You never knew, but you know what? You're part of a people that has known, and therefore it's always a return, because it's a return to our roots. Whether you knew it or not, it's always just getting back to our roots. And Rashi, it's always magnificent how Rashi finds these beautiful messages, even in like the most mundane, like Hagar went to find a wife for his, for her son. Whatever, next verse. But Rashi sees in there, you know, the way that we function, as he quotes one last thing, I'll conclude for today. Rav Hirsch has his last comment in verse 21 here, in the bottom of 358. Hope you guys are getting good at going back and forth and back and forth. This is all just to keep you awake.
Better.
Getting better.
Better.
Right? On the bottom of Rafersh. Bottom of page 358. Last week. You're looking ahead again.
I read it.
You read it already. Verse 21, already above at the end of chapter, 16, we pointed out how and how strongly the imprint of participation in the spirit of Avraham, although it is true, is only one-sided only, is stamped on the Arab descendants of Yishmael. We had a long, beautiful piece, we read that piece together, how Yishmael at least has Avraham as a father, and therefore he's a wild man, but he's a wild religious man. He prays five times a day, and his wildness is in the name of God. That's because he has a spiritual father of Avraham, and therefore that's part of it, that's part of who he is, that's part of his genetic makeup, is he has that component. Now, if we consider how, already at 17 years of age, Yishmael was withdrawn from Avraham's influence, and the maternal Hamitic influence must thenceforth have been strengthened through his wife, the ancestor of the Arab people, these Abrahamite traces so strongly marked in the Arab nation must transport us with wonder at the enduring, indestructible force which is the innate in a true Abrahamic education. Isn't that great? That was a long poetic sentence. Meaning to say, here you have a child at 17 and he's already kicked out of the house of Avraham. He was already under the influence of his mother so much that he couldn't stay in the house of Avraham. He then is reinforced by only being raised by his mother and then marries another Egyptian woman. And yet, throughout all of his descendants, the stamp of Avraham, the impact of growing up for those 17 years in such a home, the spiritual nature, what's his language? It must transport us with wonder at the enduring, indestructible force which is innate in a true Abrahamic education.
Then
which,
why do they hate us?
That's a separate question. That's a separate question.
Why do they hate us?
Like, what's going on?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, but
this is, you know, this is the same truth that we see in our own people. People who, you know, generations of Jews have been lost and they come back. There's just the strength of the innate character of the Abrahamic tradition which we have of that source which transports us with wonder. But that's the story of Shmuel. That's part two of our story. So we'll start Meretz Hashem with the Akkad, which is a very difficult story, and then we'll start going back and forth. We'll start. So we'll do the Akkad just as itself, and then we'll start. Hopefully, we'll see if we can find some interesting patterns as we go along. All right. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.